This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. Legions of Charles Frazier fans fell in love with the mountains of North Carolina, as seen through the eyes of Ada and Inman, the heroes of his best-selling novel, Cold Mountain. Frazier drew Appalachia as a character in its own right. The landscape became as familiar to the millions of Cold Mountain readers as the music that defined his Civil War-era odyssey. Frazier's newest novel, Nightwoods, came out this week. Like Cold Mountain and his second novel, 13 Moons, Nightwoods is set in a remote spot in North Carolina's mountains. But these new characters inhabit the mid-20th century, a world that moves to the pace of cars and electricity, and to the sound of James Brown coming across the Blue Ridge Mountains via the radio.
While I'm in the neighborhood, I'm gonna stop in Nashville, too. My old good old place. Where everybody's having a mighty good time. Charlotte, North Carolina.
As part of our continuing series, North Carolina Literary Lights, we're very pleased to have novelist Charles Frazier with us here in the studio. Charles, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Nightwoods just came out this week. Congratulations. And this is, in fact, the very first day of your American book tour. Tell us a little bit about the story of Nightwoods.
Well, about 1962, the main character is named Luce. She's a solitary young woman who's caretaking an old abandoned lakeside lodge and very happy to be by herself most of the time. Or at least she's convinced herself she's happy to be by herself. And then her sister is murdered and the two strange, damaged children are brought up from Raleigh and she has to figure out, they don't talk, they set fire to things, they kill chickens. So she has to figure out what's wrong with them, how to take care of them.
Cold Mountain was inspired by a story from your own family. I think it was a great uncle of yours who had come back from the Civil War. And I'm wondering if there was an initial inspiration for this book, either from your own family or elsewhere.
Well, just the place. I've had this picture in my mind of an old lodge, one of those 19th century tourist lodges where, you know, people from South Carolina and Georgia and eastern North Carolina came to get away from the heat, with nobody living in it except for one caretaker. And it was just figuring out, who is that caretaker? What's the story that goes with this place that I keep picturing in my head?
And place, as I spoke about in the introduction, clearly a major driving force. I mean, Cold Mountain, 13 Moons had, of course, their own plots, but they were as much about the place as anything else, about North Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, it's the place I know the best, place I feel the deepest for. I can imagine writing books set somewhere else, but I don't know. That's always going to be someplace I'm coming back to.
Why move after two novels in the 19th century? Why move to the 20th century this time?
It wasn't a conscious decision. I'm not sure. It's just, this was the story and this was the time and place. And I was very happy to get out of the 19th century. For a while, I never started out thinking of myself as a historic fiction writer. I just happened on a story that involved the Civil War.
And were there did moving into a time period that is within your own lifetime, within your memory, did that free you up to do certain things that you weren't able to do before?
Yeah. I mean, because the Civil War and the removal of the Cherokees have a kind of big tragedy that, you know, they were tragedies for the country. Moving to a more personal story with a smaller cast and all that changed a lot of things about the writing process. And one of the things I kind of liked and kind of didn't is when I got stuck on those two books, I'd go to the go to the library at Duke or Chapel Hill and spend 2 or 3 days and come back with a big stack of notes and a new direction, a new way to get back into the book. This one, I had to work my way back into the book by thinking about the characters, remembering the time and place.
Mm. Well, you were an adolescent, maybe about 12 years old in the time period that Nightwoods is set, I think. Where were you at that time? What was your life like then?
Oh, I was, pretty much the same things I still love, music and riding bikes and, athletic kind of stuff and reading books. Living in a very isolated, at that time, little town in the far west of North Carolina. I mean, like 2.5 hours west of Asheville.
Hmm. Well, having just read Nightwoods, it's so interesting to hear that James Brown song that we played at the beginning, because it sounds so unlike the life the characters in this book are living. I mean, the main character, as you said, Luce, she lives in this abandoned lodge with very few modern conveniences. Her friend down the road is doing farm work with a pony. Yeah. And this new modern music is coming in over the airwaves. Is that tension something that you were going for?
Yeah. WLAC from Nashville was this amazing station for a few years in the late 50s and 60s. And just those kind of 50s DJs that had personalities. And it was this just raw, powerful R&B music all night long. I learned about this character Luce by thinking about her attachment to listening to this music. She can't sleep. The lodge is kind of spooky by yourself, stays up late at night listening to this music. And what that told me about her was really instrumental in developing the character.
Well, what did it tell you about her? Because it's interesting. There's actually a moment in the book where she gets an invitation from her sort of boyfriend, Stubblefield, to actually go to a James Brown show a few hours away. And he says, we'd be probably the only white people there, and it would be great. And she says no. And was there a point when you were writing, did you think about actually having them go?
Oh, it would have been a fun scene to write. but at that point, she has these two kids, and she is determined, because she never had a model of parenthood in her own life, of good parenthood, and she's determined to take care of these kids and is worried about leaving them for any length of time.
Did you listen? Was there music that you were listening to while writing this book? Were you listening to any James Brown?
The old James Brown, the 50s James mm-hmm. Brown. That is just incredible music, and singers like Johnny Ace, and a lot of rockabilly. The kind of things that were regional hits in the South that they probably never heard up North.
Mm-hmm. I read an interview with you shortly after Cold Mountain, in which you said that the old Appalachian way of talking, that idiosyncratic way that's certainly very, very visible in Cold Mountain, maybe a little less so in Nightwoods, is going quickly, that it's hard to find folks mm-hmm. who still speak in that idiosyncratic way because TV and radio have kind of flattened out regional accents. I was wondering if in this book, in the early 1960s, is that kind of the cusp of that change?
I think so. Where I lived, we got two television stations from a huge antenna on top of the house. So it wasn't as overwhelming as now. And lots of people I knew still didn't have television in the late 50s, early 60s. But you could just see over the years as the saturation of media entered that little corner of the world, that very specific accent began to fade away.
Mm. There's, of course, also the 1960s, this period of great social upheaval across the nation, and that's something that does not seem to be in Nightwoods filtering in the same way that the music is filtering in through the radio. Is the sort of social upheaval, the social changes happening? Do you see that affecting Nightwoods or affecting the characters and the situations in Nightwoods?
Well, and I intentionally set it just before the Kennedy assassination, before the Beatles and all that flood of amazing popular music, so that this is just right at the edge of all of those huge changes that happened in the 60s.
And clearly, I mean, big changes of all kinds coming to that little community as well that you describe. This is The State of Things. We're talking today with author Charles Frazier, whose new novel is Nightwoods. And I'd love to have you read for us when we come back after a short break. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We'll be right back. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davy Aronson, in for Frank Stasio. My guest is Charles Frazier. His new novel, Nightwoods, came out this week. He'll launch his book tour tonight with a reading at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. The two most compelling characters probably in Nightwoods may be the children, Dolores and Frank. And you introduced them in the very first line of the book, describing them as small and beautiful and violent. Who are these children? Tell us about them.
Well, they're Luce's sister's children. Her name's Lily. They have witnessed their mother's murder, a really brutal killing. Haven't spoken a word since then. They may have been damaged in other ways by the stepfather who killed their mother. Luce first thinks they're just these mean little kids that are dangerous and scary, and then she comes to realize that they are also scared children, and is trying to figure out how she can meet their needs, how she can help try to reconnect them with the world.
And they really are just sort of dropped on her doorstep at this abandoned lodge.
Yeah.
One of the notable things, I suppose, from the perspective of our present time is that after the state drops them off, no one really comes and checks in. I mean, how do you think things would be different for them if this happened now rather than in 1962?
Yeah, I'm sure there'd be a lot more oversight and that kind of thing.
We first see the world a bit through their eyes at the end of the first part of the book. I mean, they've been, as you say, not speaking. And in the very last chapter of the first part, we get our sort of first glimpse of them and how they're interacting with the world. And I'm wondering if you could read part of that for us.
Sure. They sat wet-bottomed on a big flat rock at the edge of the creek, swapping a mossy crawfish back and forth. Dolores let it clamp its pincher onto her lobe like an ear bob, then pulled it off, her eyes watering from the pain. She passed it to Frank, who let it grip his lower lip with both claws until he yipped like a beagle, then into the creek again to flee backward, tail kicking. Frank lay prone, put his whole face in the creek and opened his eyes to a green-tinged world, mica-flecked sand and gravel. He breathed out, and silver bubbles rose toward the surface, tickling up his face and into his hairline. Sprawled in the grass of the creek bank, faces to the sun, they communicated in their manner with each other, trying to remember Lily, the color of her hair, her eyes, chilly mornings when they ran in and climbed shivering into bed with her, how warm she was. She smelled like wet grass, fallen leaves. The memory remained vague, just her presence and her absence. A ghost that doesn't wish you harm, but can't do you any good either. A beautiful white haze. They held memories in their heads like boxes. Some they were happy to open whenever they wanted, and some stayed closed and dark. They circled to the smokehouse where Luce had stored the unopened box of Lily's things. They ripped the cellophane tape with the point of a rusty nail pulled from the wall and sat on the greasy dirt floor in the dim, pork-smelling air. They sorted through treasures, a white rabbit fur muff, a blue leather jewelry box that opened in tiers of little empty blue velvet compartments, a green hat with a black wide mesh veil inside a hat box, a blue velvet handbag with seven identical thin silver bracelets inside, a lumpy fox stole with beady-eyed heads and hanging tails, two hard shell cases like small pieces of luggage, everything smelling of Lily's perfume, Lily's powder. Dolores held her thin arm up and dropped the bracelets one by one past the elbow, and then tipped her arm down to spill them jangling over her hand to the greasy dirt floor, then again over and over. Frank upended the muff and wore it like a hat, and then he wore the hat like a muff. Then he set the green hat, punctuated with a gold hat pin, on top of the muff, and pulled the black veil down over the white fur. Lily, though, was nowhere to be found.
Charles Frazier reading from his latest novel, Nightwoods. And that's such a beautiful scene and poignant scene of the children trying to recreate their mother through her things, which yeah. and it is it's such a powerful moment because, of course, when children do come in contact with their parents' things, they seem to have this mystical power. But then when you actually get a hold of them, they're just things. I'm wondering what inspired that moment in the book?
As you said, it's the first time you see the kids on their own in the book, really. And they, you know, as I said, been setting fires, killing chickens, very strange children. But this gives a little more sense of their loss and that they do feel that loss. They don't express it in sweet ways, but they feel it.
And the reader comes to understand that in the same way that Luce does, that they seem completely unreachable and violent, and then you have this moment where you see that they're actually really hurting.
Yeah, writing about those kids because they don't talk. You know, you take away one of your main tools as a fiction writer. So one of the challenges that I really liked with these kids is how to make them full characters without them talking.
Dare I ask if there are children on these characters are based?
Oh, I don't know. Probably no real ones that I knew.
Oh, that's probably good since they are burning some things down. They're, of course, not the only ones who are scarred. I mean, the heroine, the protagonist of Nightwoods, Luce, is a scarred woman herself. She lives this isolated existence. And I think she bears some resemblance to Ruby in Cold Mountain. And so you seem drawn to these wounded yet strong female characters. What draws you to characters like that?
Well, I'm interested in isolation, you know, whether it's physical isolation or loneliness, or however you want to label it. Interested in how people either isolate themselves or become isolated, and how they might find their way back to some connection with the rest of the world.
And one of the ways that happens in the book is Luce strikes up this sort of very, very slow romance with Stubblefield, who inherits the lodge, where she's the caretaker. Tell us just a little bit about those two characters. I mean, what's the attraction there? What draws the two of them to each other?
Luce is pretty, and that's the origin of Stubblefield's attraction. She likes that he's not the kind of pushy guy after her attention that she's known in the past. She says all that corralling and herding behavior of guys, he doesn't have those instincts.
A guy who I think and pushy would be an understatement, of course, is Bud, the stepfather of the children who comes looking for them. And so, as in your previous books, violence and especially the threat of violence really prevails in Nightwoods. I know I'm not the only one who thought of Night of the Hunter in reading the book. What draws you to the violence or people in peril? What is that?
Well, you know, those kinds of extreme situations of threat, whatever the threat is, you know, brings out interesting things in people and in characters. So you push them and push them, and they'll surprise you with their reactions to it.
Hmm. And for those who are listening who have not yet picked up the book, Bud, of course, comes after the children, but one might wonder, why is Bud not in jail for what he's done?
Yeah, he's managed to get a hung jury. So he still has the threat of witnesses coming forward that can reopen that case. But for now, he's just been told not to leave the state.
One of the ways that perhaps the primary way that Luce in this book, the aunt of these damaged children, tries to get them back into the world and tries to bring them out of themselves is through nature, taking them out into the garden and the woods and pointing out all the various kinds of plants and the life cycle of plants.
Yeah.
And we talked earlier in the program about, you know, your love for North Carolina and the landscape and the mountains. Talk a little bit about, you know, writing those scenes and deciding that one of the ways that Luce would try to bring these children back is through that landscape.
Well, some of that is that because Luce has not had a model of a mother or either parent as a good parent. Her mother runs away when she's in third grade. She falls back on teaching. Her sense of how to care for these children is more as a teacher than a mother. And because nature has been such a kind of recompense to her in life, she thinks maybe it will work that way for the kids. So how do we get our food? Takes them out to the hen house and tries to explain. If you kill all your chickens, which they've been doing, eventually you're not going to have any chickens left. And then you kind of like fried chicken, and we're not going to have any more of that if you keep killing the chickens. And just step by step, trying to make them understand the world they live in and the sort of responsibilities of living in it.
And that world and the nature that they explore. Even though this book is set 100 years later than Cold Mountain, much of that nature and the woods that they at a certain point end up getting, many people get lost in, is probably exactly the same as it was. Or is it? I mean, what do you think has changed in that relationship with the landscape and nature in that 100 years?
Well, certainly more communication, even in an isolated place like that. The roads were a lot better. There was electricity and radio, tiny little bit of television. So there was a little more daily sense of an outside world.
Mm. I know that when you're not writing, you spend a lot of time biking in the mountains, I think, and perhaps hiking. Do you make new discoveries when you're out exploring in the mountains?
I'm just sort of paying attention to the change of seasons and that kind of thing. The guys at the bike store in Asheville that I go to, it's like, oh, Charles is out there in the woods every day. That's where he does his thinking. And I'm like, no, I do not think about writing when I'm out in the woods.
That's interesting. So that's actually your time away from thinking.
Yes.
Is when you're out there. But presumably it must recharge you in some way so that you can then go back and be thinking, right?
Yeah, it really is part of the process of work for me. I get out in the woods in the middle of the day and then back to the desk by late afternoon and work.
The experience of writing 13 Moons, your second book, and then this, your third, must have been very different from writing Cold Mountain. Does having a public persona as you achieved post Cold Mountain change you as a writer or change your writing process?
Well, there is that different situation of working on a first book. There's, you know, no guarantee. The statistics are against you that it's ever going to be published. So day by day, just trying to keep the faith that that you're writing this book that some people may want to read someday. Mm-hmm. After the first one, then you're aware of an audience. But really, for me, it's every day going to work and as much as possible putting any of that behind me. Writing Cold Mountain, if I had spent a lot of time thinking, oh, this will probably never get published, it's just going to be a waste of time, you know, I would have stopped after the first 100 pages. So in both cases, it's just a matter of not letting that be part of your thinking while you're working.
Did you feel in any way that the pressure was lifted even more now being on the third novel? Because presumably after something as successful as Cold Mountain, no matter what happens, the next book is going to be this huge pressure, right?
Yeah, and that was part of what you had to keep out of your mind, mm-hmm. at least during the hours that you're sitting at the desk. Yeah, some days I was more successful than others at keeping extraneous stuff out of the process.
What do you think the hardest part of keeping up that writing day in and day out? Is that difficult for you, or is that something that you really enjoy?
Well, not day by day. I can always think of 20 things I'd rather do than go into the office, sit by myself for 5 or 6 hours trying to fill an empty screen with words. For me, I have to, when I'm really doing it, it's 7 days a week. If I take a day off, the next day's almost guaranteed to be a bad day of work. So it's just keeping the process going, keeping the momentum going. Even if you don't have time to do 6 hours, do 2 hours just to keep that story turning in your head.
You had mentioned earlier that when writing Cold Mountain and 13 Moons, which are these deeply historical novels, that you spent a lot of time in libraries. There was a lot of research to be done, and in a certain way that filled a gap, because when you hit a block, you could go and research. Yeah. And of course, writers often say that characters speak to them. Did you in writing Nightwoods? Did you find that you were having more of a relationship with the characters and hearing them speak to you with since there wasn't that intervening history there?
I'm not so much sure that was the case. Mm-hmm. It really had more to do with just that daily business of creating the world of the book. And with 19th century, you know, clearly not within my memory, so all that had to be constructed. And with Nightwoods, it is within my memory. So, you know, just trying to remember, Davy Crockett jelly glasses and Studebaker hawks and all those little physical details that you try to make a believable, concrete, fictional world out of.
So you're now on the you're setting off on this will be your third book tour, and I assume have been to the places that you'll be going on the tour before. Are there any in particular you're looking forward to going to?
Oh, the tonight at Nancy Olson's store
at Quail Ridge in Raleigh.
Yeah, it's always wonderful to be there with Nancy and her customers, and then. The Mississippi leg of the trip is always fun. Those are great stores down there and great, great bookstore owners.
And have you already started thinking about or started working on the next thing? Are you thinking perhaps of going even further into the future?
Yeah, gosh, break that barrier into the current.
Eventually,
century.
Eventually, you'll be writing about the 22nd century if you just keep on the same
science
trajectory.
Fiction. Next.
Well, my guest has been Charles Fraser. Charles, it's really been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Charles launches his tour in support of his new novel, Nightwoods, tonight at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. That event begins at 7:30 p.m. Go to quailridgebooks.com for more information. Coming up on the program, the Michael Jackson tribute band Who's Bad plays live. Stay with us on The State of Things.